Although South Sudan is one of the world's newest countries, it's already in danger of becoming a failed state because a civil war which broke out there in December 2013 shows little signs of abating. Journalist Robert Young Pelton's report on the country, including his search for rebel leader Riek Machar and Pelton's experience riding along with the White Army in combat, filled the entire April issue of Vice magazine. It's titled Saving South Sudan. I'm very pleased to welcome Robert Young Pelton to our show today. Hello.
How you doing?
You write that Sudan's modern history could accurately be described as perpetual war with some sporadic days off. Why is this country perpetually unraveling?
Well, you know, I had the great privilege of having the space and time to write something like 60,000 words for Vice, and I really wanted people to see that what you see today has echoed in the past. So if you go back to the tumultuous history between sort of the north of Sudan and the south before they created South Sudan, there was this sense that the south was a great wasteland and it was essentially good for ivory and slaves, and the north was sort of the Arab elites. And that triggered, I want to say, continual warfare from 1956 onwards. And the only peace treaties that were involved were really when people just sort of ran out of money and time and energy, and then they used that time to build up reserves and troops and weapons to start all over again. So it has been a continuous battle. What we're seeing now is a little bit different. We're seeing a tribal battle inside South Sudan, which was also part of the dynamics, but the tribes were typically united in the south against the Arab north.
What about oil? South Sudan contains 75% of what was once the unified Sudan's oil supply. How has petroleum shaped conflict in this part of Africa?
Well, it's interesting because the oil sort of in the middle of what was Sudan, sort of right on the border between the Black South and the Arab North, and there was a constant campaign by the North to sort of basically scare people off. You know, they're pastoralists. They move around between the wet season and the dry season, and the idea was that the North would drive off the tribes and then get full access to the petroleum. There's about 35 billion barrels of oil. It's actually not that much. It's somewhat of a finite amount of oil. But, you know, Sudan was always a very poor country, so that was one of their, it is probably the largest asset that they can exploit for foreign currency. And that's ultimately what led to the peace, because as long as the South harassed the North and scared off the various oil companies, the North couldn't get to it. So the creation of South Sudan, amongst many other things, was to stabilize that region and allow the oil to flow north, which, as you'll find out when you read the article, it was the goal of South Sudan to make that oil flow south through Kenya.
So would both – there are two tribes that are the main rivals here, the Nuer and the Dinka. Are they totally different, aren't they both Christian?
You'd be very hard-pressed to tell Dinka – and Nuer apart. They're Nilotic tribes. They've lived together for many years. They obviously have different cultural backgrounds, and the Dinka have sort of a V-shaped scar on their forehead in the rural areas, and the Nuer have horizontal stripes. But they typically have had a general, a live-and-let-live philosophy towards each other. And, you know, they were always united against the North. And as soon as they had to fight over the riches in the South, those fault lines emerged very quickly.
Well, the new country was led by President Salva Kiir and the now former Vice President Riek Machar. How long have both of these men been important figures in South Sudan? What had they done for most of their lives?
Historically, Riek Machar is one of the elites. He has a PhD from a London university in management. And Salva Kiir actually was the top military commander for John Garang. And John Garang was also an elite. He had a PhD in agricultural studies. And both of them were very easy to work with. And when John Garang got killed in a helicopter accident right after the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in 2005, Salva Kiir became the go-to person. And today, if you were to be very, very simplistic, you would say that Riek Machar is a very soft-spoken, educated person, and Salva Kiir is the bush soldier, complete with beard, But in actual fact, both have been rebel leaders and both have been politicians.
But were either of them equipped with the know-how to run a country?
Yes and no. When it was in their interest to bury the hatchet and work together, of course, because that's when money flows. The problem was that we, the United States, worked very hard to create this country because of a very strong sort of religious support. If you remember back in the 80s and the 90s, you know, you had slavery, you had Islamic troops, many funded and trained by Osama bin Laden, attacking the Southerners and actually taking the children into captivity and killing the adults. So there was a huge surge of support from the U.S. to create some country. That country had to be funded because it was essentially bankrupt. At that time, the oil wasn't flowing very well.
But the much of the concern was over Darfur, which is not part of this country.
No, actually, the battle raged across the entire boundary. You know, if you go back and you sort of zoom back, Darfur is essentially to one side of the country, and that's still going on because that is in Sudan. But, you know, I was up on the front lines in 1996 with thousands of Pakistanis doing suicide charges against Dinka soldiers led by Salva Kiir. You know, it was a very poorly covered war, and it had many, many conflicts and many, many famines that have not really been covered by the Western media.
Well, how extensive is the civil war today? How many people have died?
Yeah, you know, it's very hard to count because they don't bury the dead and they kind of rot. But right now, I could say 10,000 would be an estimate. It's not a high number, and it's a very unusual war because, you know, it's a very huge country. It's the size of France. And the Nuers typically are the tough guy fighters. They're the ones that bulk up the army. And they are outside of the cities because they split off from the Dinka. The Dinka are aligned with Salva Kiir and the government, but the Nuer control the countryside. And Salva Kiir has garrisons inside the town. So when they do clash, typically each side runs away. But, of course, the civilians are the ones that are damaged the most.
Well, can you
so
take... Go ahead.
Go ahead. It's not a very bloody war, but essentially people say that there is a war coming. No, the Nuer actually control half of the country, which is the half that has the oil. Salva Kiir's troops and his supporters, which includes the Ugandans, control the cities, you know, Juba and inside Malakal, but they can be chased out very quickly by these large horde called the White Army.
Well, we'll get to the White Army in a moment, but you mentioned Uganda. How did it get involved in all of this? Is it hoping to get some of that oil money?
Yeah, right now, first of all, you can thank Joseph Kony because that's how Uganda got in there in the first place towards the south.
But because he was hiding in South Sudan?
Yes, a very, very long time ago, and they had a mandate to, you know, go chase Joseph Kony in the southern part, and they just conveniently set up a relationship with Salva Kiir to create almost a billion-dollar strategic grain reserve, which is one of the contentions that Riek Machar brings up in my documentary, in that, you know, if $1 billion was authorized to be purchased, to be used to purchase grain, where's that grain and why are they starving? So Uganda became sort of handmaiden to Salva Kiir's ideas. And that's where the linkage is between the Dinka and Uganda. But when Uganda actually attacked the Nuers, it caused a huge split in that relationship.
So that's why we wound up with the president and the vice president splitting and then engaged in this fight with each other?
Yeah, well, the split's very easy. What happened is that because it's an engineered country like Afghanistan, where we helped write the Constitution, for some bizarre reason, we created a singular political party. And that meant that both Dinka, Nuer, and other tribal groups had to be within one party. And there was no sort of pressure relief if they got into tiff. So as Salva Kiir got more and more resistance from Riek Machar, he started bringing in more Dinka and more of his close insiders and pushing out the newer members of the government, which is a sort of a mirror image of what happened in 1991 when the government fell apart, or at least the SPLM, which is what they call it. So what happened is that at a certain point on December 15th, Salva Kiir accused Riek Machar of staging a coup, and he didn't mean a military coup. What he meant was what happened in 1991, Riek Machar actually called the BBC and said that he was in control of the government, even though he was in the bush and he wasn't. And that triggered a huge bloodbath between the Dinka and the Nuer, which lasted for almost 10 years.
You found rather difficult to track down Riek Machar. You wanted
well,
to talk to him.
That.
But that was later.
Soldiers. Yeah, so Riek fled to the bush because Salva Kiir tried to kill him. They sent a tank to his house to flatten it, and they killed a number of his associates. So Riek and his wife fled into the bush, and my specialty is finding rebel leaders and I wouldn't say hunting them down, but, you know, locating them and living with them and understanding the conflict. So it took me 2 weeks to find him, and we found him in a very remote area of, in the sort of the southern part of South Sudan. And I was very pleased to, you know, Riek gave us full access and talked to us at length. And to be honest, we kind of got bored after two or three days of talking all day. And I said, look, I need to get up to the fighting. And he said, well, sure, we're going to attack Malakal, and which is an oil center on the Nile. So Tim Fresia, who's the photographer who was with me, and I decided to go up into the fighting, and we were there at a very propitious moment. We were there as they invaded and took over Malakal.
Well, how do you even locate somebody like Riek Machar? Does it involve bribes and such?
No, I mean, first of all, you have to find them, and that means I use a wide network of friends. And one of the people you'll meet in the documentary and also the article is Machat, who is a manager at a Costco in Seattle. But he
a 32-year-old Sudanese lost boy. But you say that
right, complete with tattoos and facial markings. He had been a child soldier, and actually Riek Machar had killed his father, but he was a radio operator for Riek Machar. And through friends of friends of friends and, you know, just constantly pushing, making hundreds of dollars worth of phone calls by SAT to battlefield commanders, we got a hold of Riek, and we said, we're coming. And then the next problem was to find a pilot crazy enough to actually land in the middle of a rebel-held area, and that cost $17,000 for a small plane. And then it was just getting around. You literally had to travel on looted cars that had been hot-wired. You had to go find gas at $20 a gallon, and you had to hope that you made it all the way there before you got attacked or car fell apart. So it was quite difficult.
Now, Machar really seems to be pretty aware of PR, how to handle the media, and how to present himself. But according to embassy cables published by WikiLeaks 3 years after the comprehensive peace agreement was signed in 2005, Machar secretly met with the government of Khartoum to discuss what might happen if Salva Kiir were assassinated. So he's not always the statesman, is he?
No, and you have to remember, that part of the world, there has been so many people playing both sides or all sides of a conflict and then picking which side wins and then doing it all over again. And the Sudanese call that hire a slave to kill a slave, which is an old Arab proverb, which means if you back all of the people and keep dividing them, they're always weak, and then, of course, you have the upper hand. Well, Machar knows that as well. I mean, Machar is actually now in Khartoum, probably finalizing his weapons deals. They were dropping weapons to his group when I was there. And at the same time, Khartoum was publicly saying that they were involved in the peace talks and they hoped everybody kissed and made up, which means we're back to that same sort of backing all sides and then picking the winner.
Now, you mentioned the White Army. Why is it called the White Army, and what's its connection to Machar?
Well, it's a very, very strange phenomenon. It goes back to cattle raiding days when the Dinka and the Nuer used to raid each other's cattle. If somebody stole your cattle, you would essentially gather up everybody you could and go attack them with spears and whatever you had. So what Riek Machar had done in 1991 is use this sort of mythical army, because it doesn't actually exist. It's a mob, and this one was about 30,000 strong, and link up with a prophet. They have a prophet called Nundang who actually prophesies when to attack and where to attack. And Machar is always, I won't say abused, but he's manipulated that relationship to the tribal elements. I mean, these are illiterate people who herd cattle all their lives. They don't do any research. They just are told, the prophet says you have to go here. And he then decided that they would attack Malakal. And Machar was in the bush meeting with the, I think he's the grandson of the prophet, which is from that area, and decided that they would attack Malakal. And if you see the documentary, you will see what kind of damage and destruction an angry horde of 30,000 men with spears and guns and RPGs can do on a town. And it's basically a mass frontal assault with no concern for their safety or welfare. and a lot of raping and stabbing and mutilating and killing and burning, and then they loot the place and leave. And that's why journalists have never captured them on film.
Until you, in fact. But your article is called Saving South Sudan, and it also includes a three-part documentary. Our listeners can find it on our show page at WNYC.org. Just one more question. You are one of the rare Western journalists to have done this sort of thing in South Sudan. This is an area that we used to pay attention to. Why do you think it's kind of fallen off the radar?
Well, I'm writing a book called Finding Kony, which comes out next year, and what I'm trying to tell people is that the most active military command is actually AFRICOM. They have at least one mission a day. Our next war will be in Africa, and this is part one of a four-part series that I'm doing. We don't pay attention to Africa because it doesn't make sense to us. You know, it's so dense and thick and steeped in history and misperception that we just think it's Africa. You know, it's one country, it's one place, why should we worry about it? But that's where all the resources are coming from, and that's where all the fighting and the conflict between Islam and the Christian center will be. That's where the population's growth is going to be. So we do need to pay attention, and that's why Vice went big on this. First time in 21 years that they allowed an insane person like me to write the entire magazine.
Well, the U.S. sent advisors to Uganda to help fight Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army. We have not found him. Now we're sending advisors to help Nigeria find Boko Haram. Why are we having so many problems?
Well, we're using these as an emotional entry point for a much bigger geopolitical game. You know, the Chinese basically own Africa, and we're trying to elbow our way in there before all the oil and the resources are gone. So we're using these emotional windows. You know, Nigeria is a very oil-rich nation. It'll be the third most populous nation on the planet by 2050. So we need to get in there before the Chinese take everything. And so, unfortunately, we're being told this story about kidnapped children and a 52-year-old man wandering around the bush. But there's a much bigger picture to what we're doing.
Robert Young Pelton's report, Saving South Sudan, which includes a three-part documentary, soon to be a four-part documentary, is available through our website at WNYC.org, and I guess also by going to Vice?
Yeah, or YouTube. You can just Google Saving South Sudan on YouTube, and you can watch the whole thing in HD. Tim Frescia did a beautiful job. I mean, it's all high-resolution images, quite disturbing, but it captures the sense of the place.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure, Sam.